Well, we had a chance to learn about bird feathers, and we found a lot of great information there as we visited with Tor Hansen. But now we're going to take a look at bird nests with Peter Goodfellow. He's joining us by phone today from Plymouth, Devonshire, United Kingdom. And he has a new book out. He's a retired English teacher, by the way, a lifelong bird watcher. His books include Birds as Builders, A Naturalist Guide to the Birds of Britain and North Europe. And his latest is Avian Architecture, How Birds Design, Engineer, and Build. And it's a fascinating read. He's got some wonderful photography, wonderful diagrams in his book. And bird nests have often puzzled me, and I've actually have wondered at them. We had a Baltimore Oriole nest in a birch tree, and we're living on the lake, and that the birds, the orioles, built that nest, and it survived through the summer, through the winter with the winter winds and all the snow and ice, and still there in the spring. How did it happen? Well, I'm hoping Peter Goodfellow can fill us in on that and certainly answer your questions as well. Do you pay close attention to nests? Have you had an opportunity to watch birds build theirs? What kinds of birds? Give us a call with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can find it there. You'll also find a link there to Peter Goodfellow's book. So great to have him with us. Peter, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, Larry. It's good to hear that folk are so keen on wanting to know something about the book and, even more importantly, the birds' nests and how they come into being.
You start out with a really fascinating point that other than humans, mammals really aren't impressive builders, but birds are really incredibly adept. And what's more impressive is that they actually use nests for a relatively short time.
Oh, they do indeed. And this is something that surprises a great many people. There are relatively few birds that will use the same nest the following year. Some of the birds that build nests with mud, like the swallow family does, they will come along and perhaps do a little bit of repairing and relining the nest in the following year. And in Europe, we've got the colonial bird called the rook, which is a member of the crow family, and that's featured in my book. And they do indeed, if the nest is still there from the previous year in the treetop, will bring a few more sticks in and rebuild and reline it. Although they've got a rather nasty habit amongst themselves, and the male birds will come along and steal their neighbor's sticks, if that's easier than going down on the ground and getting new ones.
And the primary use of nests, eggs?
Is indeed to hold the eggs and to hold the young so that the family can, in fact, fledge. That's a general way of explaining it. There are a few birds that do, in fact, use the nests perhaps later on as a roosting place. And your cactus wren is one of those. And in North America and in Europe, the one you call the winter wren, and we simply call it wren, they are interesting because the male builds several winter wren nests, and he will roost in his own little nest. And the female will come along later on in the spring and choose one of the ones that he's built, and she will line it with feathers, and that will become the home nest. But mostly, the birds will in fact be thinking of the nest as a place of safety to rear the young.
Yeah.
There are some interesting exceptions right in my chapter one of the book, actually, where you might think that the book starts with a nest that isn't a nest.
Yeah.
you've got a plover, for example, which will just make a scrape in the sand. And there's a beautiful photograph on page 11 of the piping plover, and it's just scratched a hollow in the sand and laid its eggs there. And it becomes a safe place because the eggs are so well camouflaged in that kind of habitat, and the chicks, as soon as they've hatched and are dry, they're in a family of birds that they simply run and follow the adult and don't actually sit in the nest at all.
Yeah.
Your killdeer is a beautiful example of that, and that's in the book as well.
Yeah. And I should mention that Peter's book is published by Princeton University Press, and the Princeton folks have been really nice and sent us a few of the photos, the really nice photos that are in Peter's book. And I'm telling you, they're just absolutely fantastic photographs. And we've posted them on my Facebook page. So if you go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, you can see some of the amazing photographs that you will find in Peter's book, Avian Architecture. I did want to mention that. And Vern in Mount Hope has something that kind of goes along with what you were talking about. So let's go there. Vern, hello.
Hi there.
Hello, Vernon.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I wanted to tell you about a robin nest that I watched one year. After the robins had fledged, they moved on, and a pair of mourning doves moved into their nest and raised a brood.
Hey, that's a good one. I've heard of that kind of thing here in Europe as well. And your robin is like first cousin of the bird that we call blackbird over here. And they build a very similar nest. And sometimes birds that size, building that strong sort of nest, do indeed find that something else takes over later on. One of the things that I've heard of is not so much a dove building on the nest, but I've heard of our English robin, which is smaller than yours. That has built a nest on top of a thrush's nest or a blackbird nest. So it does happen. And what the other bird is doing is really using the first nest as a secure base on which to build its own nest. That's the way it usually goes.
Yeah.
And there are some other curiosities. If you have a look in my book and see the white stork or your bald eagle, both building huge nests of sticks, you sometimes get sparrows actually building inside the shape of the nest, putting their own little nest in amongst the sticks.
Yeah, and those nests can get to be, what, 1,000 pounds, I think.
Oh, yes, huge. Really, really very big indeed. So a small bird like a sparrow, its nest is there in a very safe place because it's not the sort of prey that the big bird will want. And it's a lovely, safe site in which to perch its own little nest of straw among the sticks.
Yeah. Vern, thank you very much. Mark in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin, will go to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Interesting show so far. Great topic. I have kind of an interesting observation and a question that relates to your last question. I had a black-capped chickadee. I believe it's the male who built the nest. He furnished a birdhouse that I had built.
Yes.
And when he basically was showing the house to his prospective mate, it was just uncanny. It was like watching a real estate showing with a male human and his mate. He literally went from the house to the bird feeder, from the house to the sump pump discharge where I have a little stream.
Yeah,
like he was showing off the neighborhood. Here's food. Here's a water supply, bird bath kind of thing. It was kind of unmistakable. Now you may say I'm anthropomorphizing, but I think if you had seen it, you would have been both pleased and kind of maybe amazed at the behavior, but it was in my mind unmistakable. He was showing off the neighborhood to his mate.
That's a very good way of explaining it, Mark. And although I've not watched that behavior with your chickadee, I have seen chickadees, West Coast and East Coast, and they are in the same family as our titmice. And the little one that we have most commonly over here is the one we call the blue tit, and a pair nested in our garden this year in a bird box, and they reared 9 young. And I have watched our little blue tit, which is very closely related to your chickadee, doing something very similar to what you've just explained. It's as if the male is the house hunter, and he selects a good site, and then by all sorts of displays, such as you've been explaining, will try to attract a mate to come to what he thinks of as his best pad. And that happens to be a nest box in your garden and ours. And it does, in fact, mean that there's a very elaborate bit of behavior, really. And according to what there is in the yard and around and about, that will help him attract attention to his particular choice of home. That's a good one.
That's
the good news is apparently it was successful because he did get her to take up residence with him. Now, the other kind of observation and question, I'll try to be quick, but I have a lot of robins around the neighborhood now, and they seem to want to build a new nest every year. They don't seem to occupy the old one, and I have a robin that I fear may be infertile because she keeps to build her nest near the back door where you
live. We're going to have to take that up after a quick look at the news. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If I say the words bird's nest, you might get a mental picture that is a cute little round cup perched in a tree. Well, there are some of those, but our guests can tell you that there's a tremendous variety in nests, including very intricately woven hanging baskets, floating islands of reeds as nests. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along on the Ideas Network. Peter Goodfellow is the author of Avian Architecture, How Birds Design, Engineer, and Build. And he's with us until 12:30 today. He has some fascinating information to share. Do you notice nests? What types of birds impress you with their building skills? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, where you can see some illustrations and photos from Peter's book. Like the page, and you'll get regular updates. News next. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about birds' nests today with Peter Goodfellow. Peter's from and with us by phone from Plymouth, Devonshire, United Kingdom. He is the author of Avian Architecture, How Birds Design, Engineer, and Build. Fascinating book with some wonderful photography in it as well. And I'm really pleased to have him along, and thank you for listening in. Questions for him, you can phone us at 1-800-642-1234, email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Peter, Mark in Menominee Falls had a comment relating to robins' nests. Do they use the same nest over and over again?
Not over and over again. They're a bit like our European blackbird. They're like first cousins. And they will usually, for a second or even a third brood, build a new nest. Sometimes robins and the blackbird will use the same nest, but I think it's more likely that they will build a brand new one. And it seems perhaps a bit of a waste of effort, some people might say, but in the general run of things, it's probably much safer to build in a new site. rather than fear that some predator may have got its eye on the old site and might move in. So I think your robin, it will probably be more likely that she'd build a new nest in the same territory that the pair have established at the beginning of spring, but probably not even in the same bush.
Marcus in Green Bay has a question for you. Marcus, or a comment. Hi, Marcus.
Hello, Marcus.
Hello. I have a question and maybe a comment or observation, but one thing I always like about nature is watching animals and plants. They always have their niche, and they're so good at everything they do, and that's why they thrive and survive. So why are mourning doves so incapable of building a good nest? They just lay a couple sticks around and they get blown over. And this year, just outside my door, there was a mother, her nest got blown down from this little box. And so she raised her young on the ground. And it's always, I always wondered, like, you know, what good does that do them to not know how to build a nest? And then the other thing is just outside of where I live, there's an area on the east side of Green Bay. It's all sandy from the glaciers. And so every year I have a return of the cliff swallows, and they burrow their nest in the side of the cliffs, and I just think that's so fascinating. And I don't know if you're, you know, familiar with the local area, but it seems like a real rare place that they can build these nests. And maybe if you could comment on that. And so,
All right, thank you for calling.
Well, certainly with the cliff swallows, that's absolutely fascinating. Yeah, although I'm over here in England, I have seen those swallows, and your barn swallow is the same as our swallow, but the cliff swallow, that really is a good one. And very many of those sorts of nests are actually very, very interesting for us folk. Any of the colonial birds that get together to build often very, very closely to each other and live happily together is a fascinating thing to watch. Going back to your mourning dove, that's very similar to the wood pigeon, which I featured in the book on page 38. And the wood pigeon is a British bird, and that too builds a very flimsy nest, so that I've seen them in a bush, and you can look from ground level up through the nest and see the two white eggs inside. It's an interesting bit of behavior, and I'm afraid I must admit that my science would not be detailed and strong enough to be able to give a good explanation as to why that particular family of birds always seems to build flimsy nests. It's good enough for them because usually they do, in fact, get away with it, and the two young ones, it's usually two, are able to fledge successfully. And your dove and our pigeon, they build again and have two or even three broods.
Yep.
It seems pretty feeble to us to put just a few sticks together, but over the time of evolution, it's worked out very well for that particular family of birds.
Mm. Thanks, Marcus, for calling. Al in Bayfield, on to you. Hi, Al.
Yeah, hi. I've got a much more basic question. I think the whole idea of how they design and engineer and build is interesting, but I'd like your guest to explain in terms that we can understand what is it about a bird's brain or head or whatever it is that goes on in its mind that says, it's time to build a nest, this is a stick I want to take and put here, and this is some grass I want to put here, and this is some stuff that I want to hold them together. How does that work? And I'll take the question off the air.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Peter?
Yeah, that's a real good one. And it digs us deep into this, actually, millions of years of evolution. And the fact that your robin or a swallow or the bald eagle builds a nest in the way that it does has, in fact, evolved over all of these hundreds and thousands of even millions of years. And it becomes then part of the genetic makeup of the bird. It doesn't get to a point where each year it sits down and thinks, right, where shall I build my house today? It comes to it from the natural instinct of the bird, and it's stimulated usually in the springtime by the rise in temperature and the increase in daylight, and this triggers hormones in the male and the female bird. They become sexually ready to mate, and away they go, and the nest building starts. It's much more of a natural, instinctive process than anything that we might think of in the way that we would sit down and start to plan about putting a house together and a home together.
Yeah. Gina had a Facebook question. Why do you never see baby seagulls?
Now, why you don't, where you might be living in North America, that I can't answer. But certainly here in Plymouth in England, we do see baby seagulls. Some of the birds are nesting out on the coast on the cliffs. But increasingly in Britain, gulls have been nesting in cities on city roofs, and then the young birds become very noticeable indeed. Compared with the lovely grey and white of the adult herring gull, for example, the young ones are very dowdy, speckled grey-brown birds and are actually very noticeable, particularly this time of year, because they've all left the nesting colonies by now, wherever they happen to be, and are spreading out very often in flocks to suitable feeding areas on estuaries, on the edge of lakes, or with certainly with herring gulls on refuse dumps.
Mm. Steve in Broadhead has a comment or question. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hello, Steve.
Hi. I'm very curious about storks, and I was wondering if you could talk a bit about them, and especially how they build in the city rather versus in the wild. And I'll hang up and listen.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have, if you like, one of the most well-known and famous of the European and Asian birds. I guess he was talking about the white stork.
Yes.
And that's in my book on page 44. And it's been hundreds and hundreds of years that they've been used to nesting close to mankind, and it gives rise to the fact that they will build on rooftops in small villages, for example. And I think that the association with man is now so ancient that that's one reason why it's down in folklore as the stork is traditionally the bird that brings the baby, the new baby. All sorts of strange superstitions surround it. But probably it began with the fact that the stork, a migrant, comes back from Africa to Europe or parts of Asia to nest, and will choose a nest site that's near where it can get suitable food. And that food is very often to be found in marshy land or in rice paddy fields or places that are irrigated, because the food is very often small fish, small eels, frogs, toads. And that very often would be near a village, is still near a village, and that slowly over the centuries grew into an association between man and the stork. And now very many villages and the villagers treat the stork as such a lovely bird to have back each year as a sign of spring again, that the birds are very much looked after.
And that you, on page 44 of your book, I have it in front of me now. It's a beautiful picture of a stork.
That's exactly the page, yeah.
It's a wonderful photograph. We had a Facebook question from Rosie. Could you talk about hummingbird nests? What does the nest look like and how large is it? Is it in a tree? Typically, how high in a tree might we ever be able to see it?
Well, if you've got hummingbirds coming to you, it is a very fortunate thing. We don't have them in Europe at all. You're very lucky to have them over your part of the world. And we've got the ruby-throated hummingbird is the one that you'd be likely to see up in Wisconsin.
Correct.
And it's a glorious little bird, which I have seen, although I've never seen its nest. What you've got is a problem, if you like, because although you may notice little hummingbirds coming to feed on the nectar in flowers in your yard, the nest is actually very tiny, and it's placed directly on top of a tree branch or a twig. And because it's so small and is perhaps no bigger than half of a walnut shell, or in my book I've said it's smaller than a shot glass, that tiny glass that you might have a shot of drink in. And because it is so small, and it's made of moss and then covered with lichen, it makes it look the same color as the tree branch. If you're not familiar with just how small it's likely to be and what color it's likely to be, you could glance in a bush or a tree and not know it was there.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Marie in Bayfield, on to you now. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I saw a program a few years ago. It was narrated by David Attenborough, and it was a bird, I think maybe in Papua New Guinea or somewhere around there, maybe an island, where the male bird would build this, what I thought was a huge structure for such a small bird. Certainly a small child could crawl in there. And he would arrange, like, petals of flowers and beetle wings and different things that he had collected to attract the female. And then they would just breed, and then she would go off and raise the young herself, because I guess there weren't any predators in this area, so he didn't have to worry about the structure that he had built on the forest floor. But it was just to attract her, to mate with her, and then I don't know if he had maybe more than one female that he would breed with, but I just thought that was really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
It is a wonderful story, and it's all very true. I've seen that film with David Attenborough as well, and if you do get a copy of my book, I'm sure you'll recognize the story in pictures and text there. It's on page 143. I'm looking at it now. And you're talking about the family of birds in Papua New Guinea and in Australia called the bower birds. And it's a fascinating bit of avian architecture, because what the male bird builds is not a nest, but is a bower to attract a female. And one of the ones that I think you must have been looking at was there pictured, the Vogelkop bower bird of New Guinea. And it does look like a little tent made out of sticks. And the decoration that he puts in front of it, as well as his singing, which he does at the entrance to his bower, does attract a female, and she will come into the bower, and they will mate. And she will go off and build an ordinary cup-shaped nest, perhaps for just two eggs, and she will rear the family herself. And the cockbird has nothing more to do with that particular female, and he then goes back to his bower, rearranges and improves his decorations, sings like mad, and waits for Mrs. Number Two to come.
And you have a beautiful photograph and a great diagram under it of the nest on that page.
That's the one. And elsewhere in that chapter of the bowerbirds, you'll see that there are bowerbirds that have got perhaps three or four different style of bower. They don't all build in quite the same way, but it's built to serve the same purpose, to attract a female with its decoration and by his singing, and she comes to the bower just to be mated.
Yeah, there you go. Bob in Jackson, on to you now. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, fellows, and good morning, Larry. So,
hello, Bob.
This is about wrens. So about 50 feet from the house, we've got a little shed, and I've got a couple of wren boxes up there, which used the last couple of years. Well, after they showed up this spring and were using the box, going in and out and taking a little stick material and whatever in, about a month later, I have in between that shed and the house a post with a sunflower feeder that I left empty for this summer. And, Larry, that relates back to the discussion with Scott Craven about the expense of sunflower seeds.
Yes.
Getting to be. But anyway.
So, I know something about that in England as well.
My goodness. So how are we going to feed them this winter? So anyway, in this empty sunflower box, these wrens started working with little sticks and whatever, and I just cleaned it out the other day. The entire bottom was full of sticks, and they had started to make an actual nest. There were little bits of, you know, string and whatever they found around the yard. And I was just wondering, what was up with that? I mean, they've got the box right there. Why would they have been looking to build another nest
inside the box?
Inside the sunflower box.
Inside the sunflower.
Right, yeah.
Had they reared any young in your first box?
Yeah, I believe they had, yes.
Right. Well, it's another example, like we've talked about in the show today, of how many of the small songbirds do go for a second brood, and more often than not, they will build a new nest.
A new nest.
Now, the fact that your new nest in the empty sunflower holder didn't appear to be finished is a sadness for you, because it would have been fun to have watched what had happened there, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
It does make me think that one or other of the pair of the wrens had in fact died or been killed, because very often with sunbirds, if one partner is lost, it doesn't easily pick up in order to get a new brood going.
Hmm.
So I suspect that a hawk had got one of your little wrens, and that was the end of that nesting idea in the sunflower box.
Yeah.
Well, we're very blessed. I mean, we've got birds all over the place. Larry's heard me call in a number of times about our different birds. We do have hawks in the area.
Yes.
So it was fun to watch, and there was no eggs laid in that sunflower box, but it was fun, and that may very well have been then. It would have been about the timing then that if they were going to do a second brood or what have you, that could very well have been it then.
Yeah.
I suspect it was, yes. Yes, indeed.
I think so, too. Well, the engineering involved in nest building is really extraordinary. The cup nests, for example, are, and here we're almost running out of time, but cup nests are often anchored to trees with spider silk.
Oh, yes. Quite a number of small songbirds use spider silk, and the hummingbirds that we were talking about earlier on in the program, that's a really excellent example. And one or two of the finches, which you have and which we have over in the UK, they too use spider silk cobweb in order to bind thin grasses and moss and lichen together in order to make a compact cup-shaped nest.
Yeah, and the weaving is, I mean, you'd think a machine did it sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Well, you started the program, Larry, by mentioning your Baltimore Oriole.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful example of a hanging nest that's been woven together with the bird just using its beak in order to do the weaving.
Yeah, it is absolutely amazing. And Peter, your book is amazing. I really enjoyed looking through it, and the photography, the diagrams, and the writing are all first rate. And I want to thank you so much for sharing with us information on how birds design, engineer, and build. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you to all your callers for all the interest that they have shown, too.
Yeah. Peter Goodfellow is the author, Princeton University Press, the publisher. And the title of the book is, I want to make sure I got it right, Avian Architecture, How Birds Design, Engineer, and Build. And I am pretty certain this you're going to enjoy it. Go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you'll get references and links to both Feathers, the first book, and Avian Architecture, the second. Thanks for listening. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.